Hey, Radio Rothbard fans. The Mises Institute has a new free book for you. Dr. Guido Holzmann's How Inflation Destroys Civilization. Learn how inflation isn't only making us poorer. It's harming our culture, mental well-being, and the moral foundations of civilization itself. Get your free copy today at Mises.org/RothPodFree.
Hey guys, this is Thoat Bishop with Radio Rothbard, and if you're listening to the show, you're no doubt familiar with Human Action, Ludwig von Mises' masterpiece. This is the 75th anniversary of its publication, and in honor of that, we are holding a very special event on May 16th through the 18th, a conference dedicated to this very important book. We're going to have scholars from all around the world coming in, including Bob Murphy, Guido Holzmann, Joe Salerno, Tom DeLorenzo, a whole list of all-star Austrian scholars. Now, as a Radio Rothbard listener, we've got a special opportunity for you. If you go to Mises.org/RRRaffle, that's double R, raffle, you can enter in to get a free admission to this very special conference. Also, if you're a student, we've got scholarships available for you at the event site, Mises.org/events. So hope to see you guys there, and now enjoy the rest of the show. Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I am Thoat Bishop, joined, as always, by my co-host, Ryan McMakin. It is AERC week this week in Auburn, so make sure to keep updated on our Mises Media YouTube page for those keynote lectures as they come up over the weekend and into next week. But this week, we've got a very interesting subject that has been in the headlines of late, the chaos going down in Haiti. And to discuss that topic, we have in a former Mises Summer Fellow with a PhD from George Mason, Marcel Gautreau, who wrote an article for Power and Market last week, American Policies Only Make Haiti Worse. And so the topic like that, I wanted to bring in someone who knows something about it. Marcel, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Good to be back on the show.
Absolutely. Glad to have you. And obviously, we have seen headlines out from Haiti. We've also seen kind of a peak fear-mongering campaign with videos of cannibal gangsters and all of this. But I think it's a very interesting sort of situation playing out real time. The collapse of a state, obviously a nation that has been subjected to almost a century now, various levels of American intervention.
Various forms of misrule.
Yes. Some great philanthropy from the Clinton Foundation, of course, after the earthquakes many years ago. Before we get into the details of this, can you talk a little bit about the background of Haiti from your perspective and kind of what has led to the circumstances that we are now seeing unfold?
How far back are we starting here? Just at the end of the Cold War or, you know, the primaries?
Well, what do you think
I think we can start in, I'd say, like the early 1900s and just start there. So America had originally invaded Haiti in the early 1900s to stop a government that was, I think, was trying to nationalize farms or, you know, some such nonsense like that. And from that point, Haiti became Haiti is not important resource-wise, but geostrategically, it's like extremely important. It is the second closest country to us besides Cuba itself. It couldn't be allowed for any other European power to establish a foothold there. America had to invade the Dominican Republic on a similar basis. From there, there were two presidents cycled through, and then a man named Francois Duvalier, who's like in Papa Doc, and he ruled for about 20, 30 years, and then his son took power. Both of them were a bit crazy, but also had like a great taste for aesthetics. The secret police under Duvalier's day would actually dress like Baron Samedi, the Haitian Grim Reaper. You can almost imagine you walk around, like, I don't know, like the Third Reich, and in the SS, instead of wearing like the trench coats and the hats, are full on dressed in like Death Eater robes. And you can imagine, you know, the kind of mindset the Papa Doc Duvalier had during his tenure as president of Haiti. America was broadly speaking okay with this, and the problems began, well, the approximately relevant problems for Haiti began during its transition to democracy at the end of the Cold War. There was an attempt at elections in 1987. Those never happened. We just forget about those. In 1990, they elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was just like this prosperity gospel Catholic priest. I mean, you've seen his type all over Latin America. He made it about a year before being overthrown by the United States. Again, nationalization, you know, then as now. He was brought back into power in 1994, because the military junta that replaced him, for the life of me, I don't remember what on earth their crime was, but you know, that was enough of that. Aristide was back into power, and then from there, every time Haiti had elections from that point, it was just a simple handoff between Aristide and then René Préval. It's similar to how in Russia, Vladimir Putin would be president, and then Dmitry Medvedev would be prime minister, and then because of Russian term limits, there was a 5-year span every once in a while where Putin would be prime minister, and Medvedev would be president, and then also at the same time, all the power of the presidency would pivot over to the prime ministership, and so on and so forth. Very similar situation there. Then Aristide was elected again in 2001. He made it to 2004 that time before being overthrown. And that one stuck. In 2006, there was a UN supervised election, and again, René Préval won anyway. And actually, at the end of René Préval's second term now, he was such a good sport that he revoked Aristide's exile. So the two of them are sort of this very interesting friendly rivalry situation. It's when you think about what the test is of a democracy, it's kind of funny here. People say, a democracy isn't a democracy after the first election, it's a democracy after the second one, because you have to see, will the ruling party like give it up? And by that measure, Haiti has technically been a valid democracy the whole time. It's never actually, no Haitian president has lost election and refused to step down. That's actually technically never occurred. And so, after 91, Haiti stood, I would say, a pretty solid chance of just being a normal sort of third world, not even despotism. Again, you know, these leaders, like, you sort of run by these left-wing leaders who were pursuing these various nationalization schemes, but nothing so problematic that it would cause, like, a refugee crisis. You know, it's something I think people need to understand, which is the fact that America is so wealthy and, you know, it's the imperial core, that is what pulls people in here. But the thing that sort of shakes people off of the branch of their home countries is usually becoming unlivable due to, you know, huge instability and crime. And Haiti in particular is very interesting in this recent instance because, in a sense, it doesn't matter, you know? And so you can sort of see all these black legends, right? These black legends take place where all these stories get made up, but it's not like it's happening in like the Middle East or it's happening in Eastern Europe where it's like America's, you know, primary foreign policy fixations are. And so you have to, so you see everybody on CNN like openly stumping and lying to your face about these crimes. Instead, you just get to see the rumors just trickle out in a way where there's no taboo against saying like, that's just obviously false. That's obviously made up. You know, so you have these stories about cannibal warlords. You have these stories about people burning people alive. And I, you know, whenever I'm in a discussion with people, I just ask them like, hey, do you have like even a slight bit of proof for any of these claims that you're making about the specific person? And they'll say, well, you know, it's like it happened somewhere. So you're like, what? It happened somewhere. Well, you know.
And of course, what's interesting right now is that, you know, with the prime minister has fled. You know, this is the government itself has collapsed on its own weight and from the dysfunction. And one of the people that have received a lot of these stories that has become kind of the infamous figure is Jimmy Barbecue Chazier. Am I pronouncing the last name right?
Chazier. The Chazier is kind of a short name.
But a former police officer who has, you know, quite a resume in his own right, certainly not a good guy per se, but, you know, I've seen social media clips trying to, again, attach, you know, oh, here's him eating bodies and the like. Can you talk a little bit about him and his role in this sort of situation? Because I know we've had some conversations off air about him. Can I introduce our listeners to Mr. Barbecue here?
Yes. So Jimmy Chirizia was originally a Haitian national police officer. He was part of, I think, an anti-gang task force. And he was fired from the police because during a raid on a neighborhood that was called, La Riviera or something along these lines. He was accused of, after two other police officers were shot next to him, beginning to summarily execute those present. Jimmy, for his part, he says that that's not what happened. Rather, there was after those two officers died, he began like a moving gunfight to retrieve their bodies. And, you know, anybody got caught in the crossfire, that's the gang's fault, which is not exactly the same thing as summarily executing people, but that's not, you know, the behavior pattern of a good person. But notice that this is the person who is not, you know, this is not a person who enjoys crime, right? This is, for whatever you can say about Jimmy there, that is not a person who's like, I love eating people and setting people on fire. That is a person who, like, really strongly does not like Haiti's criminal element. And even afterwards, so he, after being fired from the force, he took over the neighborhood group that controls his, town, which is called Delma 6, and the group is called the Delma 6 Gang. And then he formed an alliance with a group called Baz Pilat. So Baz means base, and they're named after Pontius Pilate, the Roman general. The Roman general who ordered Jesus' execution. And Baz Pilat is basically just formed of either retired Haitian police or just off-duty Haitian police. Those of you who are familiar with the story of Pablo Escobar will remember how the Colombian government had the Search Block, which was their anti-Pablo task force. But then there was also Los Pepes, people persecuted by Pablo Escobar, which was just off-duty police officers that would just flip their badges over and then start attacking people. You know, very similar phenomenon here. So, Trizier, you know, there's a lot of problems here. You know, in a functioning society, you would not want, you know, a renegade cop who's continuing to, in his off hours, do vigilante work running around. But in this situation, again, one thing that this person is not is somebody who enjoys eating people, selling drugs, burning people alive, pulling out innocent people and chopping them to pieces. And again, there's never really any evidence for these claims. I know that there are people like, for example, Dan Cohen, who has a fantastic documentary about him called Another Vision. But Dan Cohen sees Trizet as sort of this people's revolutionary. I'm not willing to go that far, but I am willing to say that Trizet is like a vigilante and an anti-crime force and is definitely not any of the insane things that people are saying about him being himself, like a violent drug dealing, kidnapping, et cetera, criminal.
So, Marcel, let's assume that I'm not really paying attention to the news very closely on this. So what is it that brought about the current situation in Haiti? That is, why were we hearing nothing about Haiti in the news for the most part in the mainstream media 18 months ago? But we're hearing a lot about it now. What is it that happened in the meantime that precipitated the current crisis in Haiti?
So it was, in 2021, where the last of Haiti's elected officials, all their terms expired. The president was assassinated, I believe, a year later. Then in 2022, there was a UN resolution passed that already authorized the reinvasion of the country by whatever multinational force could be created. And nobody, no country really seemed to be willing to do it. Most recently, Ariel Henry, he had gone to Kenya to try to coordinate the deployment of, I think, 10,000 Kenyan police officers in support of Prince to suppress the gang problem there, which honestly, I didn't think that would be enough. And so while Henry was there in Kenya, Trizier, he took the main port hostage. Now I do believe he's taken over the prison and let out a bunch of the political prisoners, including actually the accused assassins of Jovenel Moise, who it is alleged those Colombian mercenaries had been hired by Ariel Henry in the first place to take power. So the thing that has caused Haiti to enter the news most recently is that Ariel Henry has resigned, actually, I think a few days ago. But at the time, the then supposedly recognized president was unable to re-enter the country. So that was the thing that caused Haiti to re-enter the news cycle. He was even refused landing in the Dominican Republic, too. And again, Ariel Henry was never elected. Haiti has not had elections, I do believe, since 2017. There's supposed to be elections in 2019, and again, those just never happened. And after Jovenel Moise was assassinated, again, rumors say that it was Ariel Henry who had paid the mercenaries to do so. He was simply appointed by the Biden administration. And so the OAS has been having conferences, and they've tried to create like a presidential transitional council. And they've explicitly said that any person in Haiti who opposes a multinational intervention in Haiti is not eligible to be president of Haiti in the future elections, which you know, if you think about that for a few seconds, one, that's just basically saying barbecue can't be president. And two, you're also stipulating, like, you must have a specific political opinion to be president, which, you know, fine, this is what OAS does anyway. But the Presidential Council, I keep seeing people say, oh, Haitian politicians are participating in it. There are no Haitian politicians. Haiti has not had elections in over 6 years, you know, or 5 years. So there's no person who can say, like, I represent any person in Haiti. The terms have expired. You're just some guys.
And I think that's what makes it so fascinating from, I mean, thankfully from being away from the situation, obviously not away from the chaos and horror, you know, going on right now. But I mean, we've seen just the complete collapse of a state that in some measures was, you know, relatively successful, as you mentioned earlier, in terms of the peaceful transition of power, but ultimately failed its primary duties. One of kind of the protection of establishing, maintaining order in any substantive way, but also even maintaining the perception of legitimacy, you know, through the democratic process, right? Which is obviously we have issues with that definition, but that's kind of that is why they hold the elections, kind of maintain the illusion that power has some representation amongst the people here. And so, you know, it's fascinating seeing, you know, the question of what fills that void when the state no longer can fill that market for defense, that the demand for defense. It's not a surprise where you get people with guns that know how to use them that are able to bring together some of the bad people that are doing some of that crime to create order here. Marcel, where do you kind of see things going from a Haitian perspective before we go to the question of American involvement, the international response to it? You know, how do you see the situation? It is a situation that is continuing to unfold. You know, not going to hold you to any predictions going forward. But how do you see this current situation kind of developing from your perspective?
It's hard to tell. The fact that there's been this permission slip for the international community to intervene in Haiti, and there's this constant reluctance to go through with it, it's hard to tell when any intervention will occur. Again, the Kenyan government is really dragging its feet. I don't even think they approved the plan in the end. America, you know, has its hands full in a lot of other places that are way more important to policymakers than Haiti. So I think that this situation will probably persist for another few months at least. And then at that point, you know, maybe when things are a little neater in the Middle East, or when things are just slightly more managed in Eastern Europe, I think we might just see, you know, 1,000 Marines flip things over and put somebody in charge. You know, because I think if Haiti could be gotten to the level where Somalia was in the early 2000s, where at least the president was in the capital, and even if he couldn't enforce law, you know, 50 feet or 50 miles outside of that city, at least he was there. I think once America can at least get Ariel Henry, once that Haitian Transitional Council can select a president and America can make sure that guy is in Port-au-Prince, I think we're probably going to be right back out of there. I don't think, certainly the Biden administration doesn't want an election year to be bogged down in Haiti.
You're not expecting a longstanding barbecue regime in the future for Haiti.
No. I mean, he's under sanction, and that's the real, like, they've targeted him under the Magnitsky Act, as though, again, he were like a major drug trafficker. Although, again, the whole point of the Magnitsky Act is that you don't really need any kind of proof for this. Those who are not familiar, this just allows the DEA to say that such and such organization, whether it's a bank or whatever, has like possible connections, even first, second, third order connections to a drug lord. And so anybody who transacts with it can't be, can't transact with the United States. It was a very powerful war on drugs weapon. Again, I mean, who watches the show Narcos, we've seen it in like devastating effect. Since foreigners aren't entitled to due process in any way. And so even if Cherizier were to assert control over the capital city, even if he were to somebody recognized as president, you know, Haiti is sort of pre-sanctioned, pre-blockaded. And this is sort of the other geopolitical issue with Haiti, as I mentioned before, you know, its location, even if barbecue can't threaten the United States, you know, it's sort of the next frontier under sort of domino theory of like the Cuban Revolution. And even though America sort of attempted to normalize with Cuba over the past few years, there's always the risk that you know, you might, Haiti might host a Chinese military base, that Haiti might host a Chinese airfield, or just, there's a lot of things that a person in Haiti's literal physical position could do that would annoy the United States greatly. You know, with Cuba, I do believe Honduras now has a democratic socialist government. Cuba, Nicaragua, I think now, Juan Ortega is, or Daniel Ortega is back in power. So if Haiti were to join that club, this could be very annoying for the United States, even if it's not physically threatening in terms of, you know, Cuba and Haiti couldn't, you know, field a Coast Guard that would stop us transiting through the Strait. But, you know, it could cause problems.
Well, and it should be remembered that the United States also fosters chaos in Haiti by ensuring that no other power could possibly intervene there to install its own friendly regime in the sense that, okay, yes, when the United States is good and ready, the United States will come in and install whatever regime it wants. But whatever that regime is, it has to be headed by someone that's been essentially has some sort of rubber stamp approval from the U.S. intelligence community and from the American security state. Like, you can't. There's no reason to believe barbecue would be any worse than any other dictator who might come to power in Haiti. Especially if he were to establish order of some kind through some sort of brutal rule. There's no reason why he would be more brutal than whoever the CIA happens to prefer in Haiti. Yeah. But since barbecue is not a known commodity and hasn't already met with the U.S. government and provided his forever approval of whatever the United States wants to do in Haiti, then he's unacceptable. And in the meantime, it's not like the French could come in and install somebody they want. Certainly, obviously, the Russians can't do that. The Venezuelans aren't allowed to do that. So, in a sense, Haiti is held hostage by the Americans because no one else is allowed to go in and intervene and say, hey, we could start building hospitals and railroads here, the Chinese, right? You could imagine the Chinese coming in and saying, hey, we'll establish order here. We'll even invest a bunch of capital here in Haiti, and we'll provide police services and order, and we'll give you people jobs working in Chinese-funded factories and stuff like that. You could see how that would be immensely beneficial to Haitians.
Yes.
But obviously, the U.S. regime would never allow that to happen. So the U.S. prefers chaos in Haiti to some other country establishing order. And so that helps just keep Haiti in a state of chaos for much longer than would actually happen in a situation where the U.S. wasn't constantly asserting itself in the region.
Yes. So, similarly, that's why, for example, under Aristide, Hugo Chavez, there was an oil wealth or an oil revenue sharing program. Oh, yes. Haiti got very, very cheap fuel from Venezuela. Cuba often supplements Haiti's entire civil service in various periods, sending legions of doctors, even policemen, even even military trainers, again, of very limited utility to Haiti in a certain way, but it's still, it shows it shows that there are, one, people with an interest in providing useful things to Haiti, and that those people usually are enemies of the United States. Because, again, physically, it is just in a pretty good spot.
Well, and America's relationship with Haiti is fascinating, because I think in its own way, it kind of shows the change in the form that kind of American imperialism has changed over time, right? If we think back to, you know, the 1914 and kind of the early 20th century, right? You know, American intervention in Haiti, it was brutal. It was for commercial interests. You had Smedley Butler was down there running things with the Marines, but you know, it was an emphasis on roads. You know, they were trying to, you know, for the benefit of American oligarchs, but you know, there was kind of a concrete, you know, the state capacity, the will that they were willing to impose was trying to produce, you know, roads and things like that for the economic benefit of the United States. It seems that over time, kind of the notion of American intervention has, you know, it's more kind of scheme, you know, humanitarian schemes like the Clinton Foundation. And it's kind of just is unrest for the sake of unrest, you know, just in keeping these countries. And of course, that has, you know, secondary ramifications. You know, we mentioned earlier about You know, how complete disorder drives a lot of the large migration waves. I know here in Florida, this has become a big topic and concerns about, you know, boats of Haitians coming here and all that sort of stuff. So what is your kind of perspective on, you know, kind of what are the aims of American imperialism right now? You know, what exactly is our end goal here outside of just making sure that another power, that a China doesn't come in here and take Haiti for its own?
In Latin America, we're talking about?
Yeah, yes. Just more broadly, but also maybe within Haiti in particular.
Yeah, so in Latin America in general, and then this applies just as much to Haiti, the general aim is to keep countries from going into BRICS, from getting large amounts of Chinese investment, and then the possibility of Chinese or even Russian, but this is not really as much a thing, military presence or even just port presences. How can I put this? And also to ensure that these countries have as strong a reliance on the United States economically as possible. And in some cases, it's just by making sure that a significant part of their adult male population is in the United States, sending remittances back to their home countries so that those home governments can be threatened very easily with sanctions or cutting off that flow. Donald Trump actually, this is what Donald Trump was kind of alluding to when he said he was going to tax Mexico to pay for the wall. The huge amount of, for example, El Salvador's economy, I think like 20% is remittances from the United States. And you know, if El Salvador were to become, you know, a less dangerous place to live, which thankfully it has, you know, that would mean that El Salvador could have an economy of its own. You know, if you add up the policy of Democrat and Republicans together, what you basically have is the ideal vision of the United States is for, you know, 80 to 90% of the adult male population of Latin America being in the United States, but without citizenship, you know, working here for low wages and sending money there. Simultaneously not having the protections of citizenship here, but also citizens not having the protection of law from them either. And then preserving, you know, the human right for El Salvadorans to slaughter Americans, but also other Salvadorans. If Latin American countries were to, one, become safer, and two, you know, chart a development path that is not even separate. It's impossible for a country in Latin America to have an economy that is disjointed from the United States. It's never going to occur. But to have one that can't be easily, for example, sanctioned by the United States is problematic for us.
Marcel, before we get out of here, I know one element of it, we've alluded to it a few times now, is kind of the involvement of the Clintons down there. So what are your thoughts about the Clinton initiatives down in Haiti? Again, this came kind of really ramped up after the earthquake in, 2010?
2011.
Why have the Clintons been so fascinated? 2011. Why have the Clintons been so fascinated with Haiti?
Because Haiti, for some reason, after the 2006 intervention, and especially in 2011 after the earthquake, the Clinton Foundation became the de facto colonial overlord of Haiti. The International Haiti Recovery Administration, I do believe it was called, it was co-chaired by Bill Clinton himself and then the president of Haiti at the time, René Préval. All NGOs that were providing aid in Haiti, it was all managed by the Clinton Foundation. So the whole thing was a Clinton family playground. You know, there's huge amounts of money laundering, various other alleged forms of crime and corruption, which not necessarily proven, but as I say in my article, you know, Haiti was introduced to many novel diseases, both physical and social, by the Clintons in that way.
Do you have anything you want to end with, Ryan?
Well, I really like Marcel's characterization of the U.S.'s misrule in Latin America in general. And I think it just really does show where the U.S.'s priorities really are. Let no one be fooled into thinking the U.S. regime has any interest in humanitarian anything in Haiti. And you can just see by how little interest the U.S. is going to have in actually doing anything humanitarian-wise there. All they're really interested is just having a friendly regime there, and they really couldn't care less how many people get murdered in the meantime or by whatever regime the U.S. Installs. And in certain ways, then, being a country that's near the United States is a great disadvantage. It has advantages in terms of trade in many cases, like in Mexico, but it also comes with a significant amount of strategic oversight from Washington, and that can prove to be very problematic. And yeah, so I agree with Marcel's characterization of how the U.S. views Latin America, essentially in this case. They're simply not allowed to take money from Chinese corporations, Chinese government agents in any sizable way, because that's interpreted as the Chinese regime gaining a foothold there. So they cannot do in Latin America, the Chinese can't do in Latin America what they've been doing in Africa, such as building highways and railroads, etc., in exchange for rights to, say, mine local resources and that sort of thing. And that could be, of course, very good for those countries, and they should be free to accept that if they want, but they know that getting too close, I mean, many are trying to walk this fine line with the Chinese regime in terms of trade agreements and a relationship with the Chinese financial sector. But they know that if they go too far, they're going to meet reprisals from Washington. Now, this will probably be a lot of this availability of capital will probably become less so in coming years, as the Chinese economy is looking pretty shaky these days. So there may be fewer opportunities to really get some easy resources out of China. But so much more could have been had without the United States sending either a subtle or a not so subtle message that, look, you can't do too much with Chinese or with any country that doesn't meet the approval of the State Department in terms of foreign investment. And as Haiti shows and as El Salvador shows and a variety of other countries, the United States is really only interested in the strategic side of its relations with Latin America for the most part. There might be some advantages there in terms of trade, but that's not the goal of the United States. It's not to open up these economies for American consumers or American investors. It's really just to maintain strategic control, and that's disadvantaged both for Americans and for all the residents of Latin America.
And Marcel, when it comes to South America now, or Latin America, the region as a whole, now I'll end it on this note. Do you see the potential of any sort of third way dynamic there? I know like Bukele, for example, is someone who has taken a very strong approach to crime, to gangs, has gotten a lot of condemnation from certain American outlets because of that. But has been rewarded with great popularity because he's been able to fill the gaps in that the demand for security there that past regimes had brought to that area. We've seen kind of similar steps. I believe Ecuador or Uruguay, one of the nations down there, the new president kind of trying to do similar things. Even Malay has kind of adopted similar measures when it comes to some of the crime problems there. Do you see any possibility for a third? For a third way out there, away from, say, like the Chavez Venezuelan kind of classic Cuban pure socialist sort of block within the continent, perhaps more open to dealing with the BRICS, but still able to be kind of away from that the communist block, but not firmly under the thumb of the U.S. State Department? Or do you think that even those regimes will be brought to heel over time? As Washington gets more serious a bit down south rather than the Middle East or Europe.
Do I see more countries joining BRICS is what you're asking me? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, do you think there's any possibility for something different from joining, say, Venezuela, Cuba, kind of the typical kind of socialist bloc down there, but not firmly within the orbit of American influence? Is there any do you see the potential for any lasting kind of third way option for South America that is neither kind of beholden to traditional communist powers within South America or free from Washington?
Sure. And there is some good news there, which is that, you know, even though the height of the pink tide was in the mid-2010s, it really does seem as though fewer and fewer Latin American countries are eagerly electing like overt socialist governments. And in the case of Honduras, which did extremely recently, that was almost explicitly a move to repudiate the fact that both parties in Honduras were like eager collaborators with the United States. The leader of that election was the wife of the previous president, Jose Manuel Zelaya, who was removed in a U.S. coup. And that was sort of the only way she could form a union between certain, like, honestly, center-left parties. But it doesn't seem like anybody in Latin America really has, like, a strong appetite for, whether it's because they just see how it led, how it ended for Venezuela, or they just are just afraid of your surprise. It doesn't seem like anybody in Latin America was like a huge excitement to be run by like democratic socialism. But there is this desire to like, you know, to some, in some way, a sort of national independence from the U.S. So yes, I think BRICS and navigating that relationship is the thing that most people in Latin America want. And as a note on Haiti, I feel like, you know, this should be emphasized for the audience, is the number one thing that America just needs to do with Haiti is, you know, you don't really need to, I think, you know, go around feeling bad about the problems of imperialism or how, you know, how can I atone for America's crimes or are they all coming here? The number one thing I think anybody listening to this program needs to just take away is just remove the sanctions on Haiti. I think that, because it's not enough to leave a country alone by not invading them. I think that is what, when you see Haiti come up in the news, or if you see anybody talking about, you know, their cannibal warlords, or you see anybody telling you, well, this is all America's fault, or this is all the French's fault because Haiti has national debt, and any country with national debt, you know, just can't become rich ever. All you need to tell yourself and all you need to tell your friends is stop invading the country and remove the sanctions. That is all you need. That's all America needs to do.
Excellent. Well, on that note, again, I think it's a fascinating story, one that we will, I'm sure, continue to be addressed on the Mises Wire. We will link to your Power and Market piece within our show notes. We'll also link to a article from Connor O'Keefe and one that Ryan wrote a few years ago back when some of Trump's comments on Haiti were in the news. And I think, you know, everything from the decay of the state to the consequences of American foreign policy, this has a ton of stuff that a regular Mises listeners would and readers would be interested in. Any last notes or was that your send off there, Marcel?
That was my send off there. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, for Marcel and Ryan, this is Tho Bishop. This has been Radio Rothbard. Again, hope you will enjoy some of the AERC content coming up, and we will be back next week.